Rimma Brown, live,
online,
smartphones,
DSTV,
and 92.7,
and 106 FM.
8 minutes after 8 o'clock. Now, former COSATU Western Cape Secretary Tony Ehrenreich wrote an open letter to President Cyril Ramaphosa on the heritage of the coloured people on Heritage Day. Ehrenreich said in the letter that he sought to draw attention to what he described as the de-Africanization of the coloured people in South Africa, adding that the term coloured is a derogatory construct of the apartheid racial separation of people. He suggested that the term coloured be replaced by Khamisa. He went on to explain why Khamisa is a more suitable term, saying we are a growing culture that has a big part of its origins at the mouth of the Khamisa River, where there was a bustling multicultural and multinational trade station. This term Khamisa, which referred to sweet waters that emerge from this river, more accurately covers our cultural identity, and we prefer that reference to our cultural identity. Well, to discuss this question, I'm joined not only by Tony Ehrenreich from COSATU, formerly from COSATU, I'm also joined by feminist writer and journalist Gail Smith. Gail, good evening. Welcome to the program. Tony, good evening. Welcome to the show.
Good evening, Karima. Hi, Tony.
Tony, let me start off with you. What motivated you to write this letter to President Cyril Ramaphosa at this particular time?
Well, part of it was because it's the run-up to Heritage Day, and there's been a lot of discussions just within my own circles about the question of heritage and how we approach this, and many of the challenges that exist within the community that I reside in. And it seems that there's a distance between those referred to as colored, and we can discuss the naming later on, and what is happening in South Africa. And part of it, I thought, might be related to the fact that there's a sense of the colored community feeling that they de-Africanized. And it's part that because the reference is black in general and African in particular, and that definition of African excludes coloreds, whereas it includes Xhosa, Zulu, Venda, all of the other cultural groups that exist. And so there clearly is a matter that has to be attended to make it more historically accurate, because the ANC and the government, I think, says that if you have one of your forebears in Africa, you seem to be an African. And so as part of the ancestry, whether it's the Khoi or the Sun or many of the other indigenous groups that they resided around the Western Cape since the earliest days, there's certainly a historical issue that needs to be attended to. So that's really where the point comes from.
Gail, the whole question of what we call people who are supposedly not white, not black, of mixed heritage, whether it's colored people, Khamisa, whatever you call it, has a deeply, deeply political, context to it. And of course, it's something that we've been wrestling with it, for a long time. Many different schools of thoughts have called it different things. In the African National Congress, we call it the national question. What is your response to this letter, that Tony has written? Do you think he has a point, or do you think he's missing the point?
I think that Tony has a point to the extent that it is time for us to discuss the issue. I think there's definitely room to discuss the issue. I think what it raises for me is the notion that race is a construct.
Yeah.
Race was constructed in South Africa, and I think it's time for us to wrestle with the many different constructions of race. And I think colored is one of the constructions that we should be wrestling with amongst many. Where I don't agree with Tony's letter is that I don't feel that it includes me necessarily, because my own particular cultural heritage I don't feel is encapsulated in the formulation in which they put forward. I don't think that speaks to a national picture of colored identity. I think that there are many regional differences that matter and that are material. And so I don't necessarily agree with the formulation put forward by Tony in this instance, that we all sort of come from what that particular narrow stream that has been the narrow streams that have been identified there.
This is precisely why I've had both of you on the program, because whenever we've discussed the question of identity and whenever we've discussed trying to deconstruct race, and it comes particularly to this community, many people feel that it's a debate that's dominated by people from the Western Cape, maybe because of the demographics, and that all explanations of how one comes to be of mixed heritage doesn't necessarily get explained by the Cape experience. I agree with Gail that we need to deconstruct race as a construct, particularly this one. But how do you respond, Tony, to the fact that what Gail is raising is a very relevant point? I had listeners previously from places like KwaZulu-Natal calling in, for example, saying that my understanding of my mixed heritage and my coloredness, for that matter, doesn't correspond to what people are saying in the Western Cape. We are not homogenous.
I agree entirely. I mean, it's not an homogenous group, and that's part of, I think, the discussion that's got to be held. I'm certainly not for a moment suggesting that this is a conclusive definition of what any cultural group should be. That's but a small contribution to the conversation that I think needs to be held, both for the purposes of how do we establish legacy and how do the young people of today in many of the colored communities that I interact with, how do they reach back to be able to define themselves by some of the norms and standards that were in place, which are very different to the emerging cultural practices in many parts of our communities, like the gangsterism, the drug abuse, and many of the other challenges. So we need to find a way to codify and respond to the challenges that we have. And I'm certainly not suggesting that it's an exhaustive definition of what that group, or even whether there is an exhaustive definition.
Yeah.
My comment is merely in relation to my experiences here and wanting to start a conversation that deals with what is a real social question that's coming up more and more in many of our communities. And the big concern that I have on the one hand is that there are many leaders emerging who are trying to turn it into a race issue that merely creates an opportunity for them to have the same standing as some of the monarchs in some of the other cultural groups that exist in South Africa, like the Xhosa or the Zulu, where there's monetary and other benefits attributed to that. So I think it's important that we have a real discussion about it so that it's not lost in the debate that's taking place with people who want to use it, the political or other end.
Mm-hmm. You know what attracted me to your letter, Tony? It wasn't the question of wanting to address this issue. It was the fact that you made an argument that we need to undo the de-Africanization of mixed race people largely referred to as colored communities, homogenous or not. And that is what intrigued me and what interested me in this conversation, because I think there is perhaps something that we need to unpack in ways that are complex, because there's a lot of people who will say that that's precisely what they see themselves as you've decided, you've self-identified yourself as an African. I'm sure Gail does the same, and many of us do, but there are many people who define themselves as colored who don't. What exactly do you mean when you argue for the fact that we must undo the de-Africanization of colored communities?
Well, I think on the one hand, when we talk about black in general and African in particular, as the definition goes, that African would exclude colored. And coloreds can't be excluded, as just not historically accurate, because coloreds have a large part of their forebears or ancestry comes from groupings from Africa, whether it's the Khoi or the San or any of the other indigenous groups that existed or that were in Africa and South Africa in particular in the earlier times. So clearly the colored communities and a lot of their origins would put part of them squarely as part of the African community. Yet they're not recognized for purposes of the definitions in South Africa as African. And that's a matter that has to be attended to, because if anything, we must ensure that in the country we reaffirm what I think was our political identity, that we're black, we're part of the oppressed people, and we want to build this nation of all of the different cultures of Africa. And so the way that the definition is taken forward in South Africa does not take us to advance that question. In fact, I feel that it consciously de-Africanizes colored in the way, or that grouping in the way that the definition is upheld around blacks in particular and Africans in general.
Girl, what is your take?
I think that, you know, I'm not comfortable with something that seeks to broaden the discussion, but at the same time, wants to disavow and separate oneself from the identity. I think that's the problem. Mm. As a progressive person, I obviously for many years did not call myself colored because I, you know, was progressive, and for me it was just not, you know, not how I saw myself. But as time went by, it became very important to me as an individual, as an empowered, as a progressive colored person, I began to recognize that colored youth, the young people in my family, the young people that I engaged with in my community, were left hanging. They didn't really have a language and a way of talking about their own identity, and were constantly therefore on the back foot. Mm. So, you know, always having to deal with allegations of you're this or you're that or you're not black enough. And I realized I wasn't empowering them with the proper kind of language and the history to enable them to have conversations in which they could put forward an argument and not constantly feel on the back foot and shameful about it. And I think with respect to the whole issue of re-Africanization, which I think Tony is calling for, you know, I think that the perspective he's putting forward is very much one of an external process that lies in definitions. Mm. I don't think that's how we re-Africanize people. I think that this is not ancient history. This is 2-3 generations back. Mm. Most of us have family members, older people that we can speak to about our families and begin to trace our legacies and begin to re-Africanize ourselves from another perspective. I don't think this is something that can be imposed. I think there's been so much shame attached to being colored,
yes,
that people just get very, very defensive and knee-jerk. I think there's a wealth of knowledge and joy that can come from going to your own family heritage and finding out where you come from, and then from that perspective begin to speak to, about yourself as an African. I think that this externalization and the sort of, you know, idea that we can re-Africanize people through this external process of changing the definitions is certainly not a way that I think we will reach that place where people begin to speak about themselves differently and begin to reimagine themselves as part of a larger African family.
It's just gone 20 past 8. This is, of course, the Karima Brown Show. It's Heritage Day. We're talking about an important question that was raised by the former Western Cape Provincial Secretary of COSATU, Tony Ehrenreich. He wrote an open letter to President Cyril Ramaphosa talking about undoing the de-Africanization of the colored community, which, of course, speaks to the larger question of identity, race, and, of course, the question of whether there is something as a quintessential South Africanness that we strive to be part of. Tony Gail raises some valid points about the issue around shame of being colored, and of course also the fact that the community as we know it is also not an unproblematic community. Many communities that define themselves as colored do not see themselves as black. Some of us who've been involved in politics see ourselves as black, we see ourselves as African, we see ourselves as having multiple identities. But there are some within our communities who definitely see themselves as colored, as separate, as different. What do you do with that? And more importantly, as Gail said, you can't necessarily impose identities on people. Isn't it important to begin lifting the secrets that surround coloredness in many ways, and begin there, and begin right in that unit, in the family, in the community, in the church, in the mosque?
I would agree. I'm not suggesting for a moment that it be one or the other. I think on the one end, we've got to self-identify, we've got to deal with the questions about what does it mean to be colored in the absence of a definition that we may agree to. My difficulty with colored is that my understanding is it's a construct of apartheid, which around the time of the population, the registration act was used to put us into different silos as South Africans. So we've got to deal with the name, we've got to deal with the stigma that's attached to the name and to the apartheid naming system. So that's an issue that we've got to deal with. So we can't ignore that. But we've also got to deal with the fact that in South Africa at the moment, in the way the terms are defined, there is an external pressure on this grouping that is referred to as colored that makes them at the public policy level to be de-Africanized. And that's another issue that we must deal with. So there's a whole range of matters that relate to this colored community that has to be attended to. And it's not for me either or, one or the other. We've got to tackle them all. And in part it is because there seems to have been whether it's an overt or a constructive attempt at marginalizing colored communities, but it seems that there's a sense in many of the communities that they have been marginalized, and that's a question that must be responded to. In part, it's by defining our own identity and reaching back into our history and into our ancestors to do that. But in part, it's also very much a political question about where does this culture fit in to the overall grouping of African cultures. Mm-hmm. And that's something that's very much a construct of government thinking and public policy. And so that also has to be confronted so that at the same time we're dealing with creating an environment for that organic process amongst people defined as colored to emerge and capture the richness of that community.
You know, I found a very interesting Facebook post, Gail and Tony, on this. And of course, one of the people, I'm not sure if you're familiar with him, Tariq Malay, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing his surname correctly, wrote an extensive piece, firstly complaining that your letter went completely unnoticed by the Cape newspapers. I want to read sections of his post. He says, "It's unfortunate that our government and the ANC continues to champion the apartheid four-race silo approach to South Africa's people. After all the work done to repeal apartheid in all that racist era's legislation, the ANC in Parliament reintroduced apartheid separatism and use of apartheid and colonial terminology in two pieces of legislation. This is in defiance of the Rome Statute and of the ICC that describes apartheid as a crime against humanity. It was the liberation movement that fought for its inclusion in the Rome Statute. But steadily, the ANC has continued to embrace aspects of apartheid, pouring new wine into old wineskins. It also brought into the de-Africanization of those it labels colored and goes on to describe those labeled as non-African minorities and uses hated ethnicist phrases like blacks in general and Africans in particular, where those they classify as colored in apartheid style are considered to be blacks in general, but not Africans." And then, of course, he says, "Between that approach and the still dominant whiteness approach, we will never build a strong, united South Africa. We need to move away from allowing notions of race, color, ethnicity, and ideas of supremacy of Christian civilization as defining who we are." Gail, do you think that Tariq has a point about the way in which those kind of four silos has been dominating terminology, whether it is when you go to Home Affairs, whether it is when you look at an affirmative action case, whether it is when something comes before the various Chapter 9 institutions, the constitutional bodies, and is that in fact at the heart of the problem?
No, I don't think I think that the apartheid project was definitely a caste-based system. There's no doubt about it, that they created a caste hierarchy based on race, and it was tied very much into a political economy. It was a political economy that was entirely built on this caste system of, four races in a hierarchy. I think that is absolutely true. I think the idea that this all stems from apartheid is ahistorical and inaccurate.
Yeah.
I think this was very much part of the segregation era that preceded apartheid as well. But I think that what this often belies is that, inside of that contestation, there were also people who were not necessarily, mixed race because of conflict, that there were many families that were mixed race because of choice, because of celebration, because of love. My own family is one of those. My great-grandmother was an Zulu woman who married a white man. You know, so there was no necessarily colonial conquest in that. So it did create this sort of caste system. And I do think that that political economy still remains in South Africa today. So the question arises, how do we dismantle that caste system without using the terminology of that caste system? And that is where the difficulty arises, is that we are, in essence, forced to use the master's tools to try to dismantle the master's house. And that's where the difficulty of this comes into. You know, we do need to still refer to some of these, the terminology of our past. But I think that it's important for us to stop pretending like 1948 was ground zero and everything started from there. I think that's really, really ahistorical, and we need to go a little bit further backwards. I mean, I think that also you asked the question of how do we begin to lift the secrets around colonialism and the, you know, the construction of these identities. And you spoke about churches and mosques. And I think that that's a very important point that you made, because a lot of our histories lie in the churches and mosques, and particularly in the churches because of the colonial project. So those of us who are then, you know, descended from Africans who married in the Christian tradition, you know, there's a wealth of information lying in churches all around the country, in birth registries, death registries, marriage registries of the ancestry and who we are. And I think that once one begins to explore that, you begin to see a clearer picture emerging of the people, you know, who are implicated in this point in history and where we descend from. And I think it starts to broaden the picture and make it a little, you know, a little bit more nuanced. I just think that it gets very confusing when we just sort of stick to these four racial caste systems as if they were set in stone, and not the fact that they were very much created.
Absolutely. It's just gone 29 minutes after 8 o'clock. We're going to be taking a short break, but I'd like people to join in this conversation. The number to dial, 011-883-0702. After the break, I'm going to tell you two stories about my own experiences with the issue of secrets in families, and how the issue of identity was tied to economic privilege, but also in many ways tied to subversion.
It's here. Mandla and Dumi are back in the blockbuster Goodbye Bad Breath. Watch Mandla brush up his act with Nova Breath toothpaste. See Dumi swoon as Nova Breath prevents Mandla's chronic oral odors while protecting his mouth against tooth decay and bacteria. Nova Breath leaves long-lasting, pleasant, fresh breath. Use it with Nova Breath mouthwash, sugar-free lozenges, or mouth spray. Now in pharmacies and health stores near you. Nova Breath by BGM Pharmaceuticals. Kiss bad breath goodbye.
You may be intelligent, but so are machines. You may know what you need, but machines know what you want. You may work well, but machines work better. That's where we are today. Where will we be tomorrow? If you want to know what knowing means, join us on 26 September for a cyber conversation to debate man versus machine. We're creating tomorrow. We're talking about it today. Join us. Register at uj.ac.za/4ir. The University of Johannesburg. The future reimagined.
That's the sound of the rain. Healing, soothing, bringing life to the world. It is falling onto Gogo Dlamini's new RTP house. At last, a home she can call her own. That's the sound of the rain collecting in a bucket and in a coffee tin and on a small bed covered with plastic in Gogo Dlamini's house.
What? When?
That's Gogo Dlamini's son on the phone. He accepted a bribe that allowed a contractor to build shoddy RDP houses. He's been told that during the rain, some of the houses washed away.
Fighting corruption is everyone's business. Report fraud and corruption at 0800-701-701. A message from government.
Karima Brown on 702.
Well, it's just coming up for what, 37 minutes to 9 o'clock, or rather 37 minutes after 8 o'clock. I was saying before the break, I've got two stories to tell you. The one had to do with the fact that I had an English teacher, Mrs. Bosch. You know, she taught English at Salt River Highway. I went to school. And every afternoon before she left for home, she went to pop in at her mother's. And we would walk together. And as we approached the start of a station, we would enter two different parts of the station. I would enter the non-white section and she would enter the white section. But her mother, of course, lived in Salt River and was colored. But she pretended to be white. She lived in Kraaifontein. She was married to a white man. And she was a great teacher, but I could never really respect her because I felt that she was deeply, deeply unconvincing and inauthentic as a person. And then the other is much more personal. When my grandfather died on my mom's side, his surname is Green. A whole family emerged that we didn't know of. And he always used to be very, hectic about his children dating anyone from Paul. And we never understood why. And it turns out that my grandfather was actually half Jewish and that his mother died in childbirth and that his grandmother stole him and that one of his parents were white and Jewish, hence the surname Green. And the mother was colored and he was raised, by his colored family. And they almost prevented us from burying him. And of course, I'm not the only one with stories like this, Tony and Gail. We know that, comes out in many, many families. Tariq Malit says, no person should feel ashamed of their heritage. And all of us are obliged to get to understand the different heritages within our country. On Heritage Day, our focus to get to know more about each other and the ties that binds us. It is not a day of celebration of ethnic chauvinism, of ethno-nationalism. It is also not National Braai celebrating whiteness as a pseudo-culture, you know. And he goes on to talk about the fact that what he calls Afro-Europeans or in Afrikaners should stop the focus on whiteness and that there are many examples of long lines of nonconformists who embraced the continent and her people and stood up to white supremacy. Theirs is a brave and beautiful story and was not one of rejecting the European culture, but rather one of enhancing that culture with the embrace of Africa and celebrating Africa as their new home and saluting African people for embracing them in all their subcultures, whether it was Dutch or French or Portuguese. And then, of course, we have different experiences. We have the experience of colonialism, of dispossession. We have the experience of slavery, and we have the experience of genocide. And out of all of this, like you say, Gail, not all people of mixed heritages were forced or is as a result of conflict, but a lot of it was. Tony, let me start with you. You know, how much shame is there within the colored community about who we are as a people and people finding out who their ancestors are? I know within the Malay community in Cape Town, in the Muslim community, there's this kind of fascination with now going off to Malaysia and finding out what your Malaysian roots are and so on. But what about this project of undoing the de-Africanization of being colored? It's not going to be an easy thing, is it?
Well, I don't think it's going to be easy. I just want to agree with both what you and Gail say, that all of our families have the stories, the unfortunate stories about how people chose sides, and at some stage it was in their best financial interest to be classified as white, and how they tore apart families and really isolated people from one another. And a lot of that, I think, people are now trying to undo and respond to. But that's part of the challenges of dealing with the questions of ancestry. I think that in fairness to Patrick, the person that you quoted and his writings on Facebook, I've seen a lot of them, and I think it's amazing. And it comes from way before 1948 when the nationalists started to codify the racial divisions. I mean, he gives really good historical accounts of how many of the divisions have come about. And they're certainly not an exhaustive list. I mean, there are other mixed groupings and mixed families that have come about for different reasons. And that's probably going to be part of the conversation. I think the central point that I'm trying to make is that the one that there's got to be equality in the way we view the different cultural groupings. So whether it is Xhosa or Zulu or colored, whatever name you want to give to colored, there's got to be some equality. And the distinctions between them by calling the one African and the other not, that that's historically inaccurate, and that's something that has to be addressed. Because in the addressal of that, we start to undo some of the prejudice that had come about in our communities during days of apartheid, and that still lingers there, that makes us appreciate that we're part of the African continent, we're part of the family of cultures that make up the African grouping, and we're able to move forward from there a lot more, with a lot more of a constructive engagement. So I think the discussion is certainly not exhaustive, but it's an important question that big sections of the community are reaching into.
One of the things, obviously, that drives this conversation is also not just heritage and race, but it's also class. And it's a big part of the conversation. I mean, I'm always fascinated, when people, depict, particularly journalists depict housing struggles. Very recently you had, very ugly situations in Cape Town, for example, where people in informal settlements, who were largely, Xhosa speaking, were, fighting with, people from places like Mitchell's Plain, and very racist language infused that conversation. But essentially what you were looking at was, poor communities, black communities, different experiences of being black, but at the heart of it was a class conflict. People were worried about the value of their homes and the values of their properties, but it was depicted only as an explosion between black and colored communities, and in racial terms, whereas the fight that happened in places like Soweto, where informal settlers settlements were springing up, and homeowners in Soweto literally took the law into their own hands and ran those people off the land. There, the homeowners were acknowledged as homeowners, firstly, as people who have property and as people who have a right to have a concern about the price of their property being brought down by people who live across them in shacks. The story was told, completely differently. Gail, what is that about? Is that about the conditioning that we still have in our newsrooms? Is it our inability to look at the intersectionality between these issues? How do we get past discussing constructs like race without looking at issues around class and, of course, gender and sexuality, for that matter?
Well, I think you mentioned class. Certainly, it could be an issue of class, but it's also an issue, it's an economic issue, and it goes back to the race-based caste system, which was then tied to the economy. Those are all still at play here. It's not just an issue of class, it's about economic survival. And it ties back to our history, into the extent that there were many people who crossed into different classifications, not just colored people. And I think that if we're going to have an honest discussion,
yes,
about identity and about ethnicity and about purity, then we also need to bring into the conversation the scores of people and families who crossed over into colored. So you,
yes,
had the Ndlovos who became Olifants, the Mahabotlas who became Buatas. It was very much a consequence and a response to the political economy of the time. It was a matter of survival. Yeah, that people saw a prospect for survival in changing their racial classifications because there were different rewards that cohered around being a different racial classification. Those are the same narratives and discussions that are coming out in the press reporting that you're talking about today. And in many instances, we don't have a different language in to speak about it, because in our struggle for liberation as black people, we displace class to such an extent that we are very uncomfortable when it comes to class differences,
yes,
amongst us. And it invariably descends into sort of a racial Donnybrook. But there are very, very important economic realities that underlie our racial identities, and they still come out in today. And it's better that, the fact is that the caste system that was created under apartheid was very much built on divide and rule.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, when we squabble, what gets displaced is white supremacy, continued white privilege. That,
yes,
does get displaced from the conversation. And I think that we shouldn't do that to each other. We should continue, we should start to look at different ways of engaging each other and our differences that don't then give credence to that divide and rule narrative that says, you see, you can't put them in a room together and they can't get along, because it doesn't serve us as black people or colored people or people of color in general to be scratching at each other without looking at the historical roots of the conflicts that we are having.
But it's very convenient for political parties, particularly during election times, Tony, to, of course, politicize ethnicities, to politicize identities, multiple identities that people often have. We already see that in places like the Western Cape. But we also see the race baiting going on in a party such as the EFF. What is the responsibility of political parties? Because Tariq talks about a project that must happen across party lines, where we talk about ourselves as equals, but different, and how we need to advance that project. But it doesn't serve political parties, including the African National Congress. I mean, just very recently, former President Jacob Zuma referred to the ANC as a black party, and the ANC's principles of non-racialism, which I will be discussing with Jesse Duarte after 9 o'clock, is of course something that has historically been part of the organization in its 107th or 106th year existence. But you've always had political parties that have edged on people to pit themselves against each other, and invariably it's the poor within the different communities that are actually pit against each other.
Well, you're absolutely right that we've got to ensure that this discussion is a non-partisan discussion, so that it doesn't get into the wash with the political parties and their own agendas. This has got to be a question about how do we serve to bring about greater unity amongst our people. The example that you give, I think, is an instrumental one here in Cape Town, in Sakalo, and the community with Mitchell Springs. The Sakalo community was both colored and African Springs, enough. And the side of the community, Mitchell Springs, had properties of higher value and were concerned about that. And so they were on the fringes, people who were taking issue with each other. But I don't think that it was a general attitude. And that's why the point of class has to be addressed. And that's why I think that this debate about making sure that we undo the divisions, for example, what constitutes African communities and African cultures, that must be put to bed so that we know we all have our roots as African and we've got to tackle these issues together. And really what we've got to deal with together is the consequences of colonialism and apartheid. The bigger problems of today is inequality, poverty and unemployment. And we've got to have an approach towards it that deals with the systemic problems, many of which we're still inheriting from the days of apartheid. And of course, part of the mismanagement of the ANC and the government policies that's been put in place since 1994. But we're never going to get to deal with the real issues as long as we're being caught up with the divisions. So the letter that I penned was an attempt to make sure that we undo that division, that there's not a homogeneous group and there's not clarity on what the definitions or the inclusions or exclusions are. But it's an important conversation that must bring greater unity so that we then don't end squabbling amongst each other as the African community, but we're dealing with those systemic issues that really is the root cause of many of the difficulties in our communities now.
Absolutely. That's where we leave it. We obviously can go on for hours discussing this matter, but of course it's time to move on. Thank you very much to my guests, a feminist writer and journalist, Gail Smith, as well as former Western Cape Provincial Secretary of COSATU, Mr. Tony Ehrenreich.